It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, as the country starts to reopen, antibody testing is becoming more important. We'll talk about what the test does and doesn't tell us. First, it often feels like our political system is as polarized as it has ever been in modern history. We see it in Washington, D.C. with our Congress and president, and we can see it often at the state and local levels. There are a lot of factors people point to that play a role in political polarization. Ideas range from partisan maps to special interest money in politics. Some of it comes down to how our voting system works. Some state lawmakers want to change the way that system works. They're calling for a shift away from a winner-takes-all approach in our congressional elections here in the state. Representative Daniel Reamer is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th Assembly District that includes Milwaukee. He recently co-wrote an op-ed with Republican Senator Dale Coinga calling for the state to implement final five and ranked choice voting. Representative Reamer, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, to start things off, can you tell us what is the problem that you and Senator Coinga are working together to try to solve here?
Well, you talked about it a little bit already, and I don't think it'll be a huge surprise to people who live in Wisconsin, whatever side of the political aisle they tend to fall on, which is that partisanship is just so intense in our country and has become so intense that it's become difficult for legislators, for lawmakers from both parties to work together when they need to solve major problems. We've seen it before with issues ranging from tax policy, healthcare, and more recently, in a way that's become, I think, even more troubling, dealing with the COVID-19 crisis. So, you know, in some ways, partisanship is okay. We want people who have different opinions to express them and to vote for people that they agree with. By and large, and that we want our lawmaking bodies to deal with some of the issues that can't get solved just by people putting aside their differences, because our country does have major differences that need to be resolved. The problem comes when inertia takes over and we can't get things done.
Now, describe the system that you and Senator Coinga are suggesting here, I think specifically for our congressional elections in the state.
That's right. Right now, the way it works is like this. Let's say I live in a congressional district, which everyone does, but I'm a Democratic voter, which is true. I tend to vote for Democrats. I'm a Democratic lawmaker. It's not a surprise. But let's say the district I represent is overwhelmingly Republican. Let's say it's red. That's, you know, how most people describe it. Basically, I get to vote for a Democrat in the primary. And that Democrat goes on to the general election, where we pretty much know they don't really have a chance of winning the seat. And that's true, and that's how a lot of Republican voters that I've talked to who live in so-called blue districts feel. They sort of get to vote for the candidate they like, but they feel that they're largely ignored in the process because of the way the structure works, which is that in most cases, unfortunately, the individual who wins the partisan primary in a blue or a red district really ends up being the winner and ultimately heading off to Congress or to whatever elected body they're going to. So that means candidates in those partisan primaries really try to go as far as they can to the left or as far as they can to the right. Again, I don't think that will surprise a lot of your listeners to hear. I think that's intuitively something people understand. It's something that political scientists and pollsters and researchers have pointed out is in large part the way that our elections work. So the proposal and the major change, which we can talk about in more detail, works more like this. I'm a Democratic voter in a red district. Let's say I pick my preferred candidate who's a Democrat and stands for certain things that I agree with. They go through along with the top five vote getters in any particular district, and you're likely to get a range of different people. So rather than just getting a Republican up against a Democrat, and maybe a third party candidate, you get five different candidates, maybe because it's a red seat in our imagined scenario. You've got three Republicans, one Democrat, and let's say a third party candidate. Now, my first choice vote is still for the Democratic candidate. But let's say because of the change in what we call ranked choice voting, I get a second choice vote. And that gives me a reason to talk to some of the Republican candidates. That gives them a reason to talk to me as a Democratic voter. And let's say one of them supports Medicaid expansion. Even though I disagree with them on other issues like tax policy or education policy, I might give them my second choice vote and say, well, I prefer that you're for Medicaid expansion because the other Republican candidates aren't. Now, what it would do is it would say if my first choice candidate gets knocked off because they didn't get a majority and because the process works in a way we can talk about in more detail. But basically, it gives people who disagree with each other, candidates and voters, a reason to talk to each other. And the idea would be that it would then give those people who get elected, who'd be more likely to reach out across the aisle, a reason to talk to each other once they get to Congress.
We're talking to Representative Daniel Reamer, Assembly Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th District. He and Republican State Senator Dale Coinger wrote a piece together calling for a change in elections, looking to have a final five system and then ranked choice voting. So that final five is kind of the easy part here, it seems like, Representative Reamer. The primary, it's an open primary. There's not a D section, an R section, and a third party section. You got a bunch of names and you vote for them and then the top five get in. I think that's pretty easy to explain. The ranked choice, I think, is going to sound complicated to people, and it sounds to me like it might be complicated to implement.
Well, you know, major policy changes often are, and it takes a while for voters or for people affected by policy changes to get used to them. Our goal is not to confuse people, but to give them, again, like I said, a reason for a Democratic voter who lives in a red district, a reason to have a conversation and dialogue with the variety of candidates running in a congressional seat, and vice versa, to have the candidates have a reason to reach out to people who have different opinions than they do. Again, right now, we've got a system where, in most cases, and you can blame gerrymandering, you can point to issues on the maps that say, well, cities just tend to be more Democratic, other parts of the state tend to be more Republican. But one way or the other, often the candidate who wins the primary really is the person who goes on to get elected. And they have incentives to go as far as they can to one ideological extreme or the other. And it turns out that creates, I would argue, and I think Senator Coinger would agree with me, a system where in Congress and other lawmaking bodies, you get lawmakers who just can't work together because they've told voters in a public way, I'm as far to the left or as far to the right as possible. Then there's no middle ground to work together collaboratively on solutions to some of the problems that need to be addressed. So I don't disagree with you that at first this would be the kind of thing that would require voters to get further educated about how the new system works. But over time, the idea is to give voters an additional reason to participate, not to disengage and to stay involved, even though right now there's a lot of reasons that that they might just say, hey, my candidate didn't go through, or it's the kind of race where I don't really get a say. Why bother even voting? And that's really not good for our democracy.
Now, I got to ask, you're a Democrat. Senator Coinger is a Republican. I don't think people throw the word moderate at either of you all that often. What led the two of you to get together and tackle this issue in this bipartisan way?
Well, Senator Coinger, over time working together has become a friend. And it's true, we do have different partisan backgrounds. We disagree on a number of critical issues on some pretty significant ways. I'm a strong Democrat. I think he'd describe himself as a strong Republican. But there are shared values that we have that we bring to the table as a part of our service. He is a major in the U.S. Army Reserve. I'm a first lieutenant. I'm in the JAG Corps. I believe he's in military intelligence. He may have moved over to civil affairs recently. But that idea of service to our country is important to both of us, and something where through interacting with the Army, you see that people who have lots of different opinions, lots of different backgrounds, come from different parts of the country, get together and figure out how to accomplish a mission when that's what needs to get done. And so it's not a way of saying we're going to avoid are strongly held beliefs, but it's a way of saying you have to change the structure for how this works so that more voters get involved, more people who run for office interact with more voters, and through that process with a different design, you create a system where lawmakers like the two of us have a stronger reason to work together collaboratively on the biggest issues that face our country.
As we wrap up with this bipartisan approach from the two of you, are you hopeful that you can sell this to your colleagues in the legislature?
Well, that's the hope. I don't think it would be a surprise that any change to the way that we're suggesting that people get elected will be approached cautiously, I think is a diplomatic way to put it, by people who are themselves elected under the current system that we have. I had to think long and hard about it and say, gosh, is this a change that would cause me to lose? Is it the kind of thing that would mean I wouldn't win my next election? And I hope to appeal to, you know, the better angels of people's nature and say, hey, this is just a different way of doing things. It just gives you more of a reason to reach out to more people, but also to convince, you know, the lawmakers who would ultimately have to make this change that practically speaking, it's a thing to do that won't affect whether they win or lose. It will just change the way that they campaign and ultimately work with their colleagues once they do get elected. So always optimistic. I think we're off to a good start, given that we've gotten support from a Democrat like myself and a Republican like Senator Kalanga, but we've still got a long way to go to get it over the finish line. So thank you.
Representative Reamer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Representative Daniel Reamer, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 7th Assembly District that includes Milwaukee. He recently co-wrote a column with Republican Senator Dale Coinga calling for the state to implement Final Five and ranked choice voting. Coming up, we'll continue the conversation about how ranked choice voting works and what voters think about it. And you can tell us what you think about it at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how this kind of system might work? Would you like to see this kind of change where you can make your first choice vote, but then have a plan B if first choice doesn't win? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you see this as part of a solution to polarized politics? Again, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Political scientist Phil Chen of Beloit College joins us next, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about Final Five and ranked choice voting and a bipartisan call to bring it here to Wisconsin. Phil Chen joins us now, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Representative Reamer and Senator Coinga's call for ranked choice voting? Their plan would have an open primary in congressional elections. Everybody's lumped in together. Top five, they go to the finals, and then you get a couple of choices. If your first choice doesn't win in the first round, you go to your second choice, and your vote goes to them instead. Do you like that kind of change, or would you like some other kind of change? Do you think this would help, as these lawmakers do, this would help bring an end to polarization in politics? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Phil Chen, thanks for joining us again today.
Of course. Happy to be here, Rob.
Well, you heard that plan laid out by Representative Reamer along with his colleague, Senator Coinga, ranked choice in the general election, a Final Five primary. What are your initial takeaways from what you heard?
So I think like you and Representative Reamer said, the Final Five part of it is not a particularly difficult piece to implement. Provides a little bit more choice, and that's not a major sort of electoral reform. But it's important to couple it with the proposal of ranked choice voting. I think one of the big things that we tend to do is we tend to think that ranked choice voting sort of solves a lot of these problems on its own. And there are issues both with whether ranked choice voting actually empirically reduces polarization, as well as just some of the issues around representation that arise with ranked choice voting. So it can be a useful step, but it must be a step. I think that it's not enough to assume that any singular electoral reform is going to sort of magically solve issues with representation.
Now, how about that voter that Representative Reamer was talking about, the Republican in a reliably Democratic district or vice versa, the Democrat in the Republican district? This, he is saying, might give that voter a little more weight if the Republicans have to appeal to them at least a little bit to get maybe not their number one vote, but their second choice vote.
You know, I think that's the logic of ranked choice voting, and it works for individuals who have the time and the resources to be that engaged with politics. But what we know is that not everyone has that kind of time or energy or resources to be that engaged and to learn about policy preferences. I mean, in fact, we know that many voters adopt policy preferences based on their partisanship and not the other way around. This is Gabe Lenz's argument in his book that he published a few years ago. And so we know that the idea that there is somehow sort of intrinsic policies that we can then compare is ultimately a type of voting that's often restricted to those with the, you know, highest levels of education, as well as the most politically engaged.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Madison. Jay, hi.
Hi there. So I think this is a great idea. I think it's a long time coming. But I think as you guys are discussing, it's the ranked choice part is really it's hard to explain in a way that's going to get a lot of support, I think. So I'm wondering, is there anything in state law that would prevent city and county governments from adopting ranked choice voting on their own? To get people acquainted with it and understanding, because I think once people experience it, they'll get it and be like, yeah, of course. So is there anything, can we do this at the local and state level as is, or are there obstacles?
Interesting. Phil, it sounds like our state lawmakers think we could do it at the state level in a federal election. Do local and state governments have the power to make these kind of changes?
So local and state government or local governments can't make the change for instance, a federal office that needs to happen at the state level. I'm not an election lawyer, so I don't know exactly whether localities can use this to do, say, local elections, which I think is what the caller is suggesting. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
We've seen that plenty of cities have done that, not necessarily in Wisconsin, but major cities around the U.S. have adopted ranked choice voting for their local elections. So yes, that's absolutely likely a possibility.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Phil, for both halves of this, the open primary, the ranked choice, do we have a lot of this in action in places around the U.S. where we can see what its track record looks like?
So the sort of open primary, the final five primary, I don't know of a lot of places that have implemented something like that. We see open primaries, we see where anyone can vote and then the top two vote getters move through, or we see ranked choice voting without a primary system in many cases, or with a party endorsement system, but no sort of winnowing down. So it's the proposal is in many ways unique. I haven't seen this implemented very widely where you limit the number of people who can get onto that ranked choice ballot, because by nature, ranked choice voting allows for as many candidates as necessary or as want to run usually. But this is kind of a way to sort of narrow that choice set down for voters while still allowing for ranked choice voting.
And Phil, I sometimes hear from third party supporters who say they want this because it takes away that concern that you're throwing your vote away if you don't vote for one of the two major parties. At least you can cast that vote, even if it turns out to be symbolic for the Libertarian or Green or Constitutional or Independent candidate. And then vote number two goes to one that ends up having a chance of winning. Does this change the landscape potentially for third parties?
You know, I think it changes it in some sense in that it would allow for, you know, somebody to express sort of that symbolic vote for a third party. But I'm not sure it changes it in any kind of way for strengthening the parties. You know, most of our systems require, for federal matching funds or even state matching funds, require individuals to, or a party to get a certain baseline amount in a previous election to qualify for those funds. And so in many ways, ranked choice voting, because it necessarily limits down to a majority winner, those rules, those laws would have to be rewritten if we're talking about matching funds or something like that, because only the two remaining individuals who are likely to be the Democrat and Republican would actually have any votes officially counted for them. So we would have to rethink how we do matching funds and the funding systems that we have in place.
Now, with the polarization issue, as you mentioned, this ranked choice voting probably wouldn't completely get rid of polarization. I don't think the sponsors argue that it alone would do it. In just a minute, can you give us a lightning round take on some of the other causes people point to for polarization?
Well, I think Representative Reamer hit on it when he talked about gerrymandering. In many cases, this system actually requires a fix to redistricting as well. So we talk about that. A lot of polarization is elite driven, right? So it's not voter driven. It's that elites have grown farther apart. And so things like Sarah Binder talks about, you know, the causes of legislative gridlock being an increased supermajoritarian Senate. There's so many different things. I've taught an entire class on polarization, and the end result of it is we can't pin it down to one thing. It's electoral, it's institutional. There are so many pieces that move in that come about from polarization that, sure, we can think about ways to affect this and to reduce polarization, but you have to think much bigger than sort of one electoral reform. It's a good step, but it needs sort of more to it.
Phil, thanks as always for joining us today.
Of course, happy to be here. Thanks.
That's Phil Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He joined us today to talk about two state lawmakers' bipartisan call to bring ranked choice and Final Five voting to the state. They're hoping it'll help to reduce polarization in politics. We have a link, by the way, to the op-ed by Representative Reamer and Senator Coinga that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We've got a link at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about everything you need to know about antibody testing with an expert from Mayo Clinic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Schools in much of the country, including here in Wisconsin, remain closed because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But our guest says we may regret doing that. She'll explain why and make the case that they could reopen up safely. That's coming up here on Central Time. First, Wisconsin is starting to reopen along with the rest of the country, and as people start to leave their homes, there's a growing focus on antibody testing. The test tells whether you have the antibodies that are produced when your body fights off the novel coronavirus. But some are taking the results to mean they have immunity. That's despite medical professionals and the World Health Organization saying we still don't know if that's the case. Ellie Thiel is the director of the Mayo Clinic's Infectious Disease Serology Lab. Ellie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, what are we testing for exactly in these antibody tests?
Sure. So when we get an infection, our body develops an immune response against that infection. And that immune response is very complex with a lot of different moving parts. But one of those parts are these antibodies. They're small proteins or molecules that can identify the virus, and they bind to it, and they can inactivate the virus, essentially stopping it from infecting other cells. So they're one way that we get protected from infection.
And that leads to the next question. If I have these antibodies in my system, suggesting that I've had COVID-19, even if I didn't have symptoms, what do we know about whether that is protecting me from future infections?
Yeah, so that's the big question right now. For many infections, once you develop these antibodies, they kind of hang around for a long time, and they can protect you from reinfection. For other infections, though, even though you develop antibodies, they don't have that same protective power. So that's, for example, why with influenza, we have to get vaccinated every year so that we boost our immune response to the virus, which would then protect us from reinfection. So for SARS-CoV-2, you know, a lot of us expect that there will be some level, at least, of partial immunity against reinfection after you've gotten infected once. But we don't really quite know that yet. There's some studies in monkeys showing that after an initial infection, when you re-challenge those same monkeys a second time, they don't develop symptoms. But those are very initial studies, and we need to, you know, see if that same concept occurs in humans as well. And then if we do have protective immunity, the other big question is how long does that last? And so over the next few months to even, you know, years, we're going to really better understand how long protective immunity lasts after an initial infection.
And if I test positive for antibodies, does that mean I'm past the stage in having COVID-19 and carrying this virus where I can pass it along to other people?
Yes, very, very good question. So it depends. So after an individual is infected, we start being able to detect antibodies anywhere from 10 to 14 days after infection or symptom onset. And then those same antibodies can be detected for months. So if you were recently symptomatic and you tested positive for antibodies, there is a chance that you still have the virus circulating in you. On the other hand, if you know if you're tested much further out from that, say 2 or 3 months after you present with symptoms, chances are that you're not shedding that virus anymore. So it kind of depends on when you're tested. And that's why, you know, we still really rely on detecting the genetic material of the virus itself by the nasal swabs or throat swabs to determine whether or not you're shedding virus currently.
If I test positive for the antibodies and they provide some kind of immunity, that's great. Hopefully that means I don't get sick again. Does that mean that I can't pick up the virus and transmit it to other people?
Right. So that's again, the big question. And that's where protective immunity, the question of protective immunity comes in. So if we have the virus, you know, we're all hopeful that that means that we won't be reinfected again. But we still need some more studies and research to be able to say that definitively.
Right. People have floated the idea, this is for at least a month now, maybe longer, that hey, we can give immunity passports, is a phrase people have used. You've tested positive. Great. You get this seal of approval and you can go out and do your job. Easy peasy. Is it that simple?
I guess I don't think so, because, you know, once we know more about our immune response and whether truly it means that when you have antibodies, you're immune from reinfection, I think, you know, then we can feel a little safer to go out and kind of decrease those social distancing measures that we've implemented. But again, until we have more evidence to indicate that once infected, you can't get reinfected, it's going to be really hard to make those decisions based on an antibody test alone.
Talking to Ellie Thiel, director of the Mayo Clinic's Infectious Disease Serology Lab, about antibody testing, what it does and doesn't tell us about the COVID-19 illness and the virus that causes it. Do we learn anything from the potential for a vaccine as we do this antibody testing and figure out if, in fact, these antibodies do give us immunity in the short or long run?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think antibody testing is really is essential for us to understand and learn about how these vaccines work and whether they are providing immunity, because with these antibody tests, we can monitor the efficacy of the vaccines. You know, after you're vaccinated, we hope that we'll see an increase in antibodies, and then we'll be able to monitor how long those last, and those individuals will be monitored to see whether they develop COVID-19. So again, antibody tests for that purpose are going to be essential, but unfortunately, it's going to take some time in the form of months before we really understand the efficacy of those vaccines and whether they protect us from reinfection.
I want to talk about the testing itself a little bit. With the COVID test itself, I know they got the nasal swab, they put it right up in there, and then that gives them the culture. What are they actually testing? What do they need from us when they test for antibodies?
Yeah, so typically an antibody test is done from just a routine blood draw that you'll get for, you know, a variety of other sorts of routine tests. There's a lot of work looking into alternative collection methods. You may have heard of finger stick methods that are, you know, collect blood on a filter paper or a card. There's also some new emerging kind of at-home collection devices that individuals will probably hear more and more about. But the important thing is that the only type of test that we're using is one that has been reviewed by the FDA and has been granted emergency use authorization, meaning that there's a minimal level or criteria of accuracy that has been met. Because there's a lot of tests, there's a lot of different collection devices on the market right now, and we want to make sure that we're using ones that are vetted and we know perform well.
I've heard concerns, yeah, about some of these tests having high rates of either false positives, meaning, yeah, you got the antibodies, but you don't, or false negatives, meaning you do, but the test tells you you don't. How big a concern is that if we have lots of people out there who have had these tests and have the wrong info?
Yeah, it's a concern, and that's why, you know, a lot of us in the field are trying to get the message across that even if you test positive or negative at this point, we really shouldn't be making any drastic decisions on those results. There's a lot of tests on the market. The FDA has indicated that there's about 29 that should no longer be distributed because they either have not met criteria or the manufacturers have not submitted their data to the FDA for review. And then again, we're still understanding or getting a better understanding of what our immune response to this virus is. So until we understand that better, we want to maintain social distancing, wear masks when that, you know, you're around a lot of individuals in close proximity, regardless of what your antibody result is.
What would be the timeline on answering some of the questions that we've brought up here about whether antibodies can give us immunity, and if so, for how long they do that?
Well, you know, this virus, we've known about it now, and we've been dealing with it for 3 or 4 months. And in the grand scheme of things, that's really not a lot of time. You know, research into viruses and other infectious diseases and getting a really good understanding of their pathogenesis, that takes months to years. And so I think, you know, as scientists, as researchers, we've really gone gung-ho to get better clarity about this virus and its impact on us. And so I think it's going to take time. It's a new virus. Understanding all of its mechanisms of action and how we respond to it takes time, unfortunately. And that's, you know, in the range of months to maybe even years.
So correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm hearing you right, if people have had this antibody test, it sounds like you're saying really it doesn't change our behavior that much. We continue following the same safety guidelines as if we'd never had the test in the first place. Is that fair to say?
Well, for the moment, I think yes, until we know a bit more about it. I think we're all, you know, hopeful that these antibodies do provide us protective immunity, at least for a little bit of time, but we don't know how long that is. And in the interest of being conservative and being safe, we just want to continue practicing social distancing regardless of the result.
Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That's Allie Thiel with the Mayo Clinic's Infectious Disease Serology Lab. She was with us to break down the latest on what we know about antibody testing for the virus that causes COVID-19. Coming up, our guest says the closing of public schools because of the coronavirus may prove to be a big mistake. Find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new online games from the Department of Tourism let you fish in waters around the state and learn about different cultural treasures, too. We'll find out how to play. First, according to Education Week, 48 states have ordered or at least recommended school building closures for the rest of the academic year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Only Wyoming and Montana don't have those statewide orders. In Wisconsin, schools have been closed since March 18th. As a result, students and teachers are trying to do their roles online. Parents are taking on more of a teaching role. The idea here is to keep people at home and limit the spread of the virus. But our next guest says these closures may prove to be a big mistake and says schools need to reopen with safeguards in place. Deborah Saunders is the White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Her columns for Creators Syndicate appear in newspapers nationwide. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Well, thank you for having me.
Sure. Make the basic case. Why do you think we're going to regret these lengthy school closures?
So I've sat in on so many of these coronavirus task force meetings in the briefing room. I've read through the criteria, and when governors across the country were closing schools, the CDC was not recommending that they do it. Everybody talks about following the guidelines. In fact, they have these decision trees where they were saying this is what you should do if something happens. And basically, if there's no spread, don't close the schools. If there's moderate spread, don't close them. If there's heavy spread and if somebody who has been infected has been in the school, close it for 2 to 5 days and then open it. So this was never anything that was intended. Why? Well, for one thing, we know that children don't get coronavirus the way adults do. It's not as much of a threat to them. But also, a public education is important. Being able to read, being knowledgeable, that's the key to everything about life in this country for anybody, anywhere. And the idea of closing schools down, it didn't occur to them. It was just something that was done by officials across the country because they wanted to look like they were doing something.
What we've learned since then, though, is this whole thing about the asymptomatic spread. Somebody might be carrying it. You can't tell. They might have no symptoms at all. So in hindsight, is that a case that, hey, maybe this was the right call to slow down the spread?
I can't understand. Well, I mean, and by the way, we know that this has happened in school districts with no cases or really low cases in their communities. Why would you close the school for that? But also, and you know, look at, I know that this is a horrible disease. It's done horrible things to people. I don't want to sound as if I don't care about that. But it's also a horrible thing to take away a child's ability to read. And their kids, they're never going to be in the third grade again. And what happens if they don't learn how to read? So I think it's, you know, what I would like to see happen, and I think it is happening across the country in different places, you start to open the schools up. Parents who don't want to send their kids to school don't. And parents who want to send their kids, they have a place where their kids can go. And obviously, they're going to be really careful, social distancing, lots of hygiene, lots of hand washing, finding different ways to use buildings so that kids are not too close to each other. But, I think that the thing that just has blown me away from the beginning of this is that people just didn't really talk about the consequences. And I think it's because the people who are the decision makers, they're knowledge workers, right? They're like you and me, and they know that they can take care of their kids somehow from home. Won't be easy. They can do it. Well, what happens if you're if you're a single mom and you're a grocery checkout person? What does that do for you? What if you're a nurse? There are a lot of people who have had a lot of trouble dealing with this, and the idea that they can teach their kids, poor people, people who came here who are immigrants and really don't know English well, what are they going to be able to do for their kids? And what's astonishing to me, I would go on to these think tank discussions they'd have about education, and they'd have these discussions about making sure that people had better laptops and 5G, but they weren't talking about what this is doing to kids, and they weren't talking about what this is doing to kids who are in the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder.
We're talking to Deborah Saunders, White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Her column for Creator Syndicate appears in newspapers around the country. We're talking about a piece she wrote making the case that we should be getting kids back into school sooner, not later, questioning the decision, at least in many places, to close schools in the first place. Do you see, at least now that the decision has been made, we've got guidelines from the CDC, do you see schools trying to make sure they're reopening safely whenever that reopening might happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what's happening. There is now pressure on lawmakers to open things up. But I do think that there has to be more. It scares me when I hear some schools talking about not opening the doors, the actual doors, until September. What is going to happen to young kids who have completely missed everything? We used to hear them talk about how summer would, a lot of kids, they'd after 2 months at home, they'd come back to school totally unprepared. What do you think this is going to do? And how are we going to make up for it? You know what? It blows my mind. Two words I can't believe I don't hear. Summer school. Why aren't we talking about opening up the doors and letting some kids come in and have remedial learning for what they missed? Why is it that it's okay with people that this has happened and that children are being left without an education when statistically there's not a good reason for it? And again, any parent who doesn't want to send their child to school, there may be comorbidity in the family, their child may have pre-existing conditions. Obviously, you want to do everything you can to accommodate them. But the idea that I'm not also entirely sure kids are safer. I know when I was a teenager, I wouldn't necessarily be doing what I was supposed to do during a shutdown.
Let's bring on a caller now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. I know this is a briefer segment, so I'll try to keep my comments short. I think the guest is being disingenuous in the basis for claims, considering what she's saying about CDC guidelines, very carefully choosing her timing. CDC guidelines when everybody was closing schools, blah, blah, blah. I think the point and the claims are disingenuous. She's talking about missing third grade and not learning how to read. Kids learn that in kindergarten and first grade. I think the concern and the claims are made on false pretenses and with false sympathies and are just to further a political agenda. This is
Michael, I'm going to jump in because we do just have a couple minutes left. Michael, saying the CDC has updated claims and better safe than sorry, even if it means we're losing a couple months of education, I think, Deborah.
Well, I mean, the first couple months, the CDC was not calling for schools to be closed down across the country. You know, there are a lot of kids who go to school every day and don't know how to read. About 35% of kids in school read it, in fourth grade, read at grade level. So it's not a perfect system to begin with. And I think you're going to find that number is going to skyrocket when kids actually go back to school on a regular basis.
And in our last couple minutes, Deborah, what would you like to see if there's a resurgence of COVID in the months to come, say in the fall? What kind of conversations do you want to see happen before, you know, the next school closing decision or not is made?
Yeah, I mean, look, I understand why governors did this, but we were all panicking. We were scared. And of course, people want to protect their children. But I think that there ought to be a way to accommodate people who want to send their kids to school. At the very least, and that instead of just deciding everything has to be closed, I think there has to be a way that we can try to accommodate people who want their kids to go to school, and you know, basically that's it. Obviously, you want to have hygiene practice, you want to have social distancing. I'd say to the extent you can have kids be outside where it's really much harder to get the virus, do things like that. But instead of just panicking and running, think of how you can move forward and don't leave kids behind. There was a report that A Nation at Risk that came out in 1983, and the people behind it talked about how if a foreign power had done to American schools what has been done to American schools in terms of mediocre education, we'd be up in arms. Well, we've heard the phrase, this is the invisible enemy, but I think our panic has been an enemy, too, because I just don't think it's good for kids.
We'll leave it there. Deborah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Deborah Saunders, White House correspondent for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Her columns for Creators Syndicate appear in newspapers around the country. We talked to her today about why she says it might have been a mistake for schools to be closed long-term during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can share your thoughts and your perspectives in your local district, whether you're a student, a parent, a teacher, or administrator. Email ideas@WPR.org. Or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. What are you hoping to see as schools start to reopen, possibly in the fall? Here's a story for you. Hidden artifacts tucked away in a national monument, and they've been unearthed after hiding away for more than a century. No, it's not a national treasure movie, and as far as I know, Nicolas Cage was not involved. 100 years ago this month, the Arlington National Cemetery's Memorial Amphitheater was dedicated. That came after 5 years of construction. At the beginning of the project in 1915, the cemetery's directors created a time capsule to be placed in the building's cornerstone. This month, as planned, cemetery staff opened, very carefully, the cornerstone, took out a treasure chest, opened it up and found another metal box inside, carefully opened that, and then they found the original time capsule. Also hidden in the cornerstone, one empty jar of Peter Pan brand peanut butter. The contents of the actual time capsule included a copy of the Declaration of Independence, a copy of the Constitution as it existed in 1915, no votes for women, no alcohol ban, no repeal of the alcohol ban, plus a flag, some stamps and coins, and some daily D.C. area newspapers. What about that peanut butter jar? The workers on the project decided they wanted to leave their own record, so they gathered up business cards and wrote little notes with their names on them. They found the first container they could find to get it into the cornerstone fast. Getting back to the official time capsule, the artifacts and documents were sealed and wrapped in actual government red tape. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.